Hi, and welcome to Prosody, our weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tyhimba Jess. Tyhimba Jess was born in Detroit. Mr. Jess's poetry bridges slam and academic poetry. His first collection, entitled Lead Belly, published in 2005, is an exploration of the blues musician Huddy Leadbelly Leadbetter's life, and was chosen for the National Poetry Series by Bridget Pegeen Kelly. It was voted one of the top three poetry books of the year by Black Issues Book Review. A two-time member of the Chicago Green Mill Slam team, Mr. Jess was also Chicago's poetry ambassador to Accra, Ghana. He is the author of African American Pride, Celebrating Our Achievements, Contributions, and Enduring Legacy, and his work has been featured in numerous anthologies, including Soul Fires, Young Black Men in Love and Violence, Slam, The Competitive Art of Performance Poetry, and Dark Matter 2, Reading the Bones. His honors include a Whiting Writers Award, a Chicago Sun-Times Poetry Award, and a Gwendolyn Brooks Open Mic Poetry Award. A former artist in residence with Kaveh Kanem, Mr. Jess has been awarded fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Illinois Arts Council, and the Fine Arts Work Center at Provincetown, as well as a Lannan Writing Residency. Hi, Tyhimba. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Great to be here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you. This is your first time on Prosody, so welcome. And you're going to start with some new poems, right?
Absolutely, yes. Thank you. Okay. I just want to preface this one that is that it was inspired by Pastor Jerry Jones, the guy who was burning Korans a little while ago, a couple years ago, and around that time I was asked to write a poem for the 9/11 memorial celebration that they had at the College of Staten Island, and I really didn't know what to think of. So here is what I came up with: Risen. Smoke rises from the pages of a burning book to join the smoke of other burnt books, joining their languages in the wind with the bodies of those who burned with them. Those burned in buildings where they toiled at their work, where they called their husbands and wives on their lunch hour. Those burned in buildings where they sat or knelt or touched their heads to the ground or rocked themselves to the rhythm of their joined and solitary prayer. Now all speaking, praying, singing in the language of smoke. Smoke from each library of books, from books believed in, sworn by, for the breaths they've shaped from generation to generation, for their armies of tongues, for the simple way they've made us more human with their stories, making us think we understand how and why and when our kind came to be so blindingly human. We have reveled in the words of these books, books stacked spine to spine like a congregation of rapt believers infused with the words of their own maker. We have opened each book's body to share its salvation and purpose. We would become one with its maker and royal in the heat of its words, words now abandoned in flame, smoking as if from a tower pointed up to heaven. One packed with believers, jammed spine to spine, crying for their maker into their rising smoke. Or words smoldering into the ground like a bonfire that leads the way to more and more burning. Words like salam, shalom, and peace flicker in our faces as if we could see the very faces of our lost in each fire. Word by word, soul by soul, letter by letter, breath by breath, as if each pyre could consume the desire to consume. The way we think each touch of each loved one's hand might still the thirst for more touch. The way each word in each book might teach us how and who we are until we find ourselves pulling our loved ones, ourselves, our books clamoring in every language yet to be translated into smoke out of each towering flame, knowing and holding our stories in our hands. This one is entitled Habeas Corpus, America 2012. You have the body, ankle and hip, each parted lip and each hair, the body with its sweat-stained heat and its cough. The spleen and tongue of the body is yours from navel to spine. You have the body bundled like a fist, shuttered in darkness, bound, bloodied, under suspicion. You have the body blistered with accusation, hooded, blinded, manacled, maced. You have the body electrified, born unto the body of the Republic we stand in stress position. You have the body numbered, targeted, locked, firing sequence initiated, search warrant expired when you have the body expired. Exploded, the body preening in the wedding party, in a car speeding through night, in the morning before prayer, trial held in the head of the soldier flying bodiless, remote drone from his body. I am the body in this voice. In my silence, the body rots, the body unwilling to answer when you have the body and the blood on the body you have. The body stretched and waterlogged, named and unnamed, foreign and domestic, accusation in the eye of the body plucked out. You have the body shipped into concrete and photographed, stripped. You have the skull and the penis and the heart of the body. Each vulva and opening, the digital record of the body as it writhes. You have the body definitively, indefinitely, the body huddled in the shape of our body. The body you have is the body you have. You have the body. And mercy. The war speaks at night with its lips of shredded children, with its brow of plastique and its fighter jet breath. And then it speaks at daybreak with the soft slur of money unfolding leaf upon leaf. It speaks between the news programs and the music of commercials, then sings in the voices of a national anthem. It has a dirty coin jingle in its step. It has a hand of many lost hands, a palm of missing fingers, the stump of an arm that it lost reaching up to heaven, a foot that digs a trench for its dead. The war staggers forward, compelled, inexorable, ticking. It looks to me with its one eye of napalm and one eye of ice, with its hair of fire and its nuclear heart. And yes, it is so human and so pitiful as it stands there, waiting for my hand. It wants to know my answer. It wants to know how I intend to show it out of its misery, and I only want it to teach me how to kill.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Taimba Jess. He's reading some new poems for us. Taimba, I wanted to ask you about the sense of order in your poems. Mm-hmm. I feel a strong sense of order, but I can't tell exactly what it is, but in terms of perhaps repetition or repeating images, sound, but I feel an orderly feeling in there. I don't know if if that rings any bells for you.
Yeah, I think that in these, particularly in the ones that I've just been going over, there is a sense of repetition, you know, especially with the, you know, with the idea of the burning of the book and the recycling of that image, and with the idea of habeas corpus, you know, you have the body coming back and back and back and back. And, I think the war speaks at night, you know, I think it's recycling the image of the, and reexamining the image of the war and personifying the war in various and sundry ways. So I think I am trying to come back to the image and reimagine the image in various ways every time.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as a poet who wants that structure in a poem or needs that structure in a poem?
You know, I never really thought of it that way, but maybe that's true. I never really thought of order very much. It's only recently that I've really explored form in particular. For most of my writing career, I was pretty averse to form, but now I seem to be pretty enveloped in it.
Hmm.
So, yeah, when I think of order, I think of form, mm-hmm. and I think that I think of it in a way kind of like music, in that I like to find the rhythm somewhere in the music. Mm-hmm. And I think that repetition brings me back to the music. I can always hit the one, but then I can go off and go on an excursion and go wherever the rhythm or wherever the improvisation upon the rhythm may take me, but then there's always the rhythm to rescue me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty ingrained pretty deeply into my sense of poetry.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's more what I was talking about, not necessarily the structure of a formal poem, but I think there's form in all poetry, you know,
with
line break is part of a form.
Yes.
And I think sometimes people forget that, but there's form everywhere.
Yeah.
I really liked when you said, in the poem, when you said, the body you have is the body you have. I think that's brave. The body you have is the body you have, and you have the body. I thought, no, he's not doing that. Yes, he is. But I thought, yeah, that's great. But it's one of those moves where I think people are afraid to make that move, and yet when it's made, it has so much power that repeating, you know?
Yeah, I think that one snuck up on me too. It happened, and I was like, oh, wait, you can't do that. Well, maybe you should.
It's always like that, you can't do that.
Right, the little editorial board in your mind is
kill that editorial board.
Throw it in the trash.
Okay, can you read some more?
Absolutely. I think I'll read some from my book, Lead Belly. The book is a collection of poems that are written in the voice of people and objects around Lead Belly, and also Lead Belly himself. And Lead Belly, born 1885, died 1949, played 12-string guitar. He was a fantastic guitar player, stands at the cornerstone of American folk music. But this one is taken from his, all these poems are taken from his biography. So this is Lead Belly's Lessons. Mr. Haney owned Shreveport's general store, where a dollar a week brought my 12-year-old frame's lift and lunge of barrel and crate across a sawdust floor. Still, he wanted more. See, the guitar refused to get naked with Haney. He would fumble up the seams of its hidden croon, hook, clasp, and bodice of each tune mangled down to a stunted strum. So he quit. He'd hoist bourbon and order me to hoist song. The velvet locomotive of marrow deep hum I tote up from the swollen center of guitar. Its catch and slide caught between palms and cradled across Louisiana starlight. His bottle and scowl grew louder with each reel and jump that I played while getting paid to show the way of undressing music from its wooden clothes. But it was like coaxing stone to bathe in sky. He never let his flesh wallow in the blue floating round his earth, so he buried himself deeper in his own dirt. He'd think on the hurt a white man can do without second thought. He'd slur, "Nigga, someday I'm gonna kill you," and stagger home. It was there, alone, in the dark darkness of me, that I first learned the ways of pure white envy. And thank you, Mr. Haney, for teaching me. And this next one I'll read is from the viewpoint of Lead Belly's mother, Sally Leadbetter, a mother's hymn. When the black boy climbs out of my womb, how to peel dynamite from his bones? How to strip tornadoes' hum from his ears? How to weed graveyard from his garden of tongue? What rainbow of prayer to pull between teeth? How to blind him from liquor's sun of stupor? How to sow whisper into his hurricane of hips? What blizzard of plea to freeze his tremor of feet? How to lift him from streetlight blaze? Which revengeful breast fed him this poison? Which breast gilded his mouth with song? And I'll also read this poem here is in the voice of his longtime extra special companion. She was not very tall, very curvaceous. She got around quite a bit. Her name was Stella, and she was his guitar. So this is Mistress Stella Speaks. You think I'm his property, 'cause he paid cash to grab me by the neck, sway me across his knee, and stroke the living song from my hips. You think he is master of all my 12 tongues, spread notes thick as a starless night, strangling spine till my voice is a jungle of chords. The truth is that I owned him. Since the word love first blessed his lips, since hurt and flight and free carved their way into the cotton-fused bones of his fretting hand, since he learned how pleading men hunt for my face in the well of their throats till their tongues are soaked with want. Yes, each day he comes back home from the fields, from chain gang fury, from the smell of sometime women who borrow his body. He bends his weight around me like a wilting weed, drinking in my kiss of fretboard across fingertip till he can stand up straight again, aching from what he left behind, rising sure as dawn.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Tayimba Jess, and he's reading some poems from his collection, Lead Belly. Tayimba, you said something like the poems were taken from the biography of Lead Belly.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean exactly? They were taken from the...
Well, they're based on real life events of Lead Belly's life,
uh-huh.
And constructing the book entailed trying to research as much as I could about his life. There were a few books in particular that came in hand, like The Life and Legend of Lead Belly. John Lomax also left behind quite a bit of documentation about his experience with Lead Belly, although they had a contentious relationship. So I spent about 5 years researching his life and also writing about it and eventually came up with this book. So all of the events that take place in the book are factual.
In your book?
In the book, yes. What I do is I kind of go in between the events and try to think about what the people or the objects were thinking when the events were happening.
Okay. Well, how can you write sort of in a project mode? I mean, were those only the poems you were writing at that time? Or
I did write some other poems, but not very many.
Mm-hmm.
I got a little bit obsessed. I finished the book while I was in my MFA program at NYU, and pretty much every week they knew what was going to come. It was going to be a Lead Belly poem.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was a gamble, and in that if you weren't interested about Lead Belly, then hey, well, I guess it wasn't going to interest you. So the trick was how to get you interested. Or get a reader interested, and then get myself interested in it, and challenge myself to come with different ways to come at the idea of Lead Belly and what happened in his life. And in the course of that, there were several themes presented themselves, such as his relationship with the prison industrial complex, with the recording industry, with academia, with anthropology, his relationship to migration. He was part of a migration from south to north. And there was a love story involved as well between him and his wife, Martha. So it gave me an opportunity to look at events that were happening 100 years ago and compare them through the verse subconsciously in a way to what is happening today. You know, so when you're talking about just after the Civil War, he's born 1880s, right? And you're talking about the turn of the century, you're talking really... That's when the Industrial Revolution is starting. Everything's, and America is coming into its own as an empire. You're starting to see the blueprint for the 20th century, and you see a lot of the traces of that blueprint in his life story, mm-hmm. particularly for the African American community. You see a lot of those lines being drawn in his life, those storylines, I should say.
Okay, well, are you saying then that you were like organically obsessed with this? Like you had to write these lead belly poems, and so it wasn't like you say, okay, I need a poem about this part of it, or I need a poem about this part of it. It just was coming and coming out of you, or
well,
do you know what I'm saying?
Well, what happened was I wrote one, and then I wrote another one, and then I wrote about five of them, and then I was at a workshop called Cave Canem, which I'm very happy to be a part of. It's a workshop of African-American poets. And I got some great feedback about the poems at that particular workshop. And then I said, well, I'll make 10 poems and then make it part of a book. And eventually it grew to 20. I said, I'll just do one section of his life. And eventually I said, once you're at 20 poems, maybe I should just do the whole thing, do his whole life. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I looked for the points of tension in his life, you know, the points where decisions were being made, you know, mistakes were being made, and I kind of took those as guideposts in his life to try and figure out where that tension was, and I followed it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you going to read more Lead Belly or?
Sure, I'll read one more Lead Belly, and then we'll read some other stuff. Is that
okay?
Okay, so how about this one is based on the he had a wife who was 17 years younger than him, and they got married after he'd done two stints in prison, and he had no real job prospects available. Nevertheless, he had a relationship with this woman whose name was so poetic. I felt like it kind of forced its way into the text. Mm-hmm. Her name was Martha Promise. Mm-hmm. So Martha Promise receives Lead Belly, 1935. When your man comes home from prison, when he comes back like the wound and you are the stitch, when he comes back with pennies in his pocket and prayer fresh on his lips, you got to wash him down first. You got to have the wild weed and tree bark boiled and calmed, waiting for his skin like a shining baptism back into what he was before gum barrels and bars chewed their claim in his hide and spit him stumbling backwards into screaming sunlight. You got to scrub loose the jail time finger smears from ashy skin, lather down the cuff marks from ankle and wrist, rinse solitary stench loose from his hair, scrape curse and confession from the welted and the smooth, the hard and the soft, the furrowed and the lax. You got to hold tight that Shadrach's face between your palms, take crease and lid and lip and brow and rinse slow with river water. And when he opens his eyes, you tell him, calm and sure, how a woman birthed him back whole again.
Martha Promise.
Martha Promise.
That's a wild name.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he was, his relationship with her pretty much helped him center and focus and at the time that they married, he was entering his 40s or so, and he had seen prison twice. He knew what that road led to, so he made an effort to really turn himself around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. I know you're going to visit the county jail here.
Yes, I'm really glad to be visiting Words Without Walls, and I'm going to be sharing some of this poetry with some of the folks that are in that program. Mm-hmm. in the county jail.
Allegheny County Jail. And Words Without Walls is a program that's housed at Chatham University.
Yes.
And it seems like a really great program. But it's great that you're going to Going to go in there and do some poetry.
Well, you know, I think the thing about it is that just as music was a kind of salvation for Lead Belly, you know, words have been a kind of salvation for myself. And I think that kind of salvation can be witnessed by anybody who's willing to open themselves up to and explore the word in ways that will explore the world and themselves at the same time. So I'm really glad to be visiting with some folks who may not be able to afford much at this time, but they can afford their words,
right?
And they can afford the effort to put into creating a different world for themselves through the page. So hopefully we'll see what happens. I'm really psyched. I've heard a lot about these students in the program, so I'm really looking forward to meeting them.
Well, great. And it makes you think about, I think about Jimmy Santiago Baca,
right,
and his story about just coming alive in prison through poetry. I mean,
right,
things happen and lives change.
It can still be a place for rehabilitation.
Mean poetry or prison?
Both.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
There you go.
Okay. We have time for a couple more poems.
Okay. Well, what I'll do is I think I'll read a couple poems that are about the Fisk Jubilee Choir. Okay. So you may or may not be familiar with the Fisk Jubilee Singers. These poems are from a double crown of sonnets that I wrote about them. Jubilee Indigo. How do we prove our souls to be wholly human when the world don't believe that we have a soul? How do we prove black souls holy and human when the world swears we ain't got no soul? We hitch our voices to a heavenly plow and sow the seeds of a righteous mission. After we've spent our voices up, how do we know that these church songs make a difference? After we spent our voices, how do we know that these Bible songs make a difference? We'll know by the quiet moment that follows our song. We'll know by the solemn silence. We'll sow our sacks full of liberation hymns, hauling them across every nation. And I'll read, here's another one from that same crown of sonnets. Oh, sing unto the Lord a new song, born from newly freed throats, sprung loose from lungs once bound with embonded skin, scored from dawn to dusk with coffle and lash, every tongue unfurled as the body's flag, every breath conjured despite loss we've had. Bear witness to the birthing of our hymn from scorned depths of America's sin. Soul-worn psalms, blessed in our blood through dark lessons of the past, struggling to be heard. Behold, the bold sound we've found in ourselves that was hidden, cast out of the garden of freedom. It's loud and unbeaten, then soft as a newborn's face, each note bursting loose from human bondage.
The poetry of Taheem Burgess. Thank you so much. We're out of time. It was great.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've been listening to Prosody, our weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.